Hello and welcome to edition 347 of the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck, and Robert Bound.
On the show today, we'll be looking at London. It's London Fashion Week, after all, and some of its legendary fashion pioneers. Writer and author Dana Thomas will be here to tell us why the city has a style like no other.
And we'll be having a printing masterclass from artist, designer and printmaker Won Jin Ho. She'll be telling us how her designs made it onto new coins being produced by the Royal Mint.
Plus, we'll be speaking to John Darlington from the World Monuments Fund. John will be telling us about the Ancient Lives Project, a collaborative online effort to translate thousands of papyrus messages found in Egypt. So we'll try to lend him our expert advice.
That's all coming up. Plus, Monocle's Henry Rhys Sheridan will be trying to nail down next week's big stories. And we'll enjoy some new music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
That was a very chipper menu, wasn't it? It was pacey, it was fresh, it was all the things that we promised this show is always going to be. We've got some great sounding guests lined up, but before we do that, we know the running order of this show. How on earth are you, Andrew Tuck, this Sunday?
I'm all right. I've still got a bit of a hacking cough.
It's been a bit of a wheezy week for you this week.
I know, I've been coughing and spluttering. I think it's quite good to have a deep voice, though. I think that's I might try and keep that bit.
Well, that's definitely sexy. You know that in each of the two studios here at Midori House, there is a cough button. Have you utilised it? It's one of those things that's slightly for show, isn't it? It's quite good to know, to tell listeners that it exists.
I was doing Midori House a couple of days ago, and my coughing was so bad, I had to get out of the chair and go into the corner of the room and cough like some kind of dying dog, while the poor guests just carried on chatting to each other. But anyway,
we booked some professional guests here, at least. Right?
They seem to cope with my phlegmatic approach to things. Anyway.
What about other things that you would have a button for? I mean, I'm not talking about bodily noises, but I favour a giggle button. Sometimes you kind of get the giggles, don't you? Especially on this show, which has an element of bonhomie to it. Less successful when you giggle through a discussion about, Middle East affairs. Well, it's not quite so good.
You get sent some crazy glasses this week, and I saw you at one point imagining what it would be like doing the news.
Quite serious news.
Because those are the only glasses you could find.
That'd be good, wouldn't it?
Yeah, that'd be good.
Nice.
And maybe an on-off button for Tom Reynolds.
That'd be good, yeah. Yeah, if he was kind of like a robot that you could just switch on when you wanted to be
entertained and shown dog pictures, and then switch off again when you've had enough of looking at dog pictures.
Precisely. One thing I learned this week, after much criticism in the office and in the Barley Mow, the pub next door to the office, that Instagram is not a website, it's an app. No one knows what that means. I think if we're talking about the future, then we should get in our news expert. And that, this week, is Henry Rhys Sheridan, isn't it, Andrew? Should we beckon him into the studio?
Let's get a little Henry in. Henry, oh Henry, love the way you jump and rock. All right, Henry, oh Henry, love the way he takes his hop. But how am I doing now? Everything is all right. Did you call me Little Henry as I was coming between the control room and the main studio?
Oh, I didn't know you were doing that, but yeah, that's what I called you, yes.
You asked, what's going on with your seating arrangements?
I don't know, it's very low down.
Very low. You are living up to your recently arrived at moniker.
Give yourself a raise.
I quite like this vantage point, actually.
So for our listeners, these chairs that we have, there's a paddle on the side, which if you kind of move it it's a nice Eames chair, but if you move the paddle, you can rise up. Some guests just don't work it out.
There are several different mechanisms. There are several different points of manipulation on the chair.
But I have had a serious guest during a show, and I've kind of instructed them how to kind of move it up, and they've kind of pulled it, and they've gone down even further until their kind of little chins are on.
That's
when
you need
the
giggle button.
Yes.
Are you familiar with? And they also have a safety lock to stop you tipping backwards, and you can release that,
you can
and
release
it turns
that
into an almost a rocking chair.
Yeah, it's pretty.
Anyway, we've all got jobs in furniture demonstration now.
Should we?
Should we do the news?
I'll see you down World of Leather, Andrew. Is that a bit like the mail rail?
I was going to say, how did you know I went there?
I turned it into luxury flats now. Nothing's the same.
On that note, Tuesday, the 1st of March, next Tuesday, a very important Tuesday. Some call it Super Tuesday. It is the Tuesday where the highest number of states in the United States of America are going to hold their primary and caucus races, 12 states this year. Super Tuesday, interesting history. Do you want to give me a little bit of a history?
Go on.
It started in 1984. The point was, the Democrats started it, and the point was, first of all, to boost the power of a consortium of southern states to be able to influence the nomination process, and also to wean out weak, flailing candidates to avoid a... Because basically, you know, you get a much clearer idea after so many states have voted. Who's winning, who's losing stops a protracted, self-destructive race over a long time.
Kick out the cooks that are spoiling the broth kind of thing.
Precisely.
Yeah.
Do you remember February the 5th, 2008, gentlemen?
Shall I look at my diary? I found my old diary upstairs.
Well, that
is, is it Becker's party?
That day was the biggest Super Tuesday in history. It became known as Super Duper Tuesday, Mega Tuesday, Giga Tuesday, Mega Giga Tuesday, Tsunami Tuesday, and the Tuesday of Destiny.
Oh,
from some, 24 of the 50 states held their nomination competitions on that day. Wow. Remarkable. That is remarkable. 13 states this year. No, excuse me, 12. I think it's 13 states and 12 states and one kind of weird territory.
Okay.
But, yeah, everything should become
so
slightly...
It's not so Super Tuesday anymore, then, if it's only half the number.
I mean, that's still more states than any other day of the week.
Okay.
You know, I think it still deserves the moniker.
Okay.
Personally.
I like this.
Any questions?
I feel kind of... It's putting me in the mood of Friday My Love by The Cure somehow, this kind of naming of days. I kind of like it. Can I ask you a question, Henry?
Yeah.
Is this the day, then, that will decide the nominees for each party, especially probably the Republican Party, which looks less close than the other guys?
It won't decide any. You can't win enough votes on that day to actually clinch the election, but you can come awfully close.
Right.
So we should have a much better idea.
It's
all been a bit speculative, hasn't it, so far? And obviously, you know, Iowa and New Hampshire are so specific unto themselves that everyone makes a big hoo-ha about them, but you can't make many predictions from them. So... should be fun. Tuesday, put it in the diary.
I will put it in the diary. I think it's already written in my diary. There's about 52 of them.
Excellent. mark this one with an S for super.
Super. S.
Highlight
Tuesday.
It.
Okay. Where are we going to next, Henry?
Next, we are going to Spain. Wednesday the 2nd of March, there is a vote of confidence in the socialist-led minority coalition government taking place. Basically, the socialist party, the PSOE, reached an agreement with the centrist Cuidadinos party. I think I'm pronouncing that incorrectly. The deal was signed in a letter, and now there has to be a little election to try to measure who's winning. Quite boring.
It's a piece of parliamentary cake.
It's a piece of parliamentary cake.
Okay.
Let me try and make this interesting, though.
Yeah. Why not put some icing and a cherry on it?
Precisely.
Okay.
Bloomberg Business Week. Today, article released, breaking with old politics may begin with clock change in Spain. The 36-year-old head of the Cuidadinos is trying to shift Spain back onto Greenwich time as part of a broad package of measures aimed at bolstering economic growth and reviving democratic institutions. It was part of the deal that he signed with the head of the Socialist Party that I just spoke about. Although Madrid is further west than London, the sun rises as much as an hour later in the summer, Spain runs an hour ahead of the UK, and they think that that's having a harmful effect on the country's economy, because people wake later, they work later, they're out of sync with the main engines of the economy in their time
I
zone.
I couldn't live in Spain. I couldn't live in Spain, especially Madrid. Dinner at 10, I can't handle it.
Well, dinner at 10 if you're lucky.
If you're lucky, yeah.
Well, meetings at 8 p.m.
Man
sometimes,
alive.
Just before dinner. Remarkable.
That's where you need a nap in the afternoon.
Yeah, see, I can't nap, so I couldn't handle that. I don't like that. I'm all in favour. I like that.
And change interestingly, the time was changed initially in the first place. Franco changed it to align the country closely with the Axis powers who are on that time. So it hasn't always been that way. So this would be a symbolic break from the past as well.
So it was GMT before Franco changed it.
It was.
You've done very well today so far.
This is really good. Tom Edwards.
You can have one more.
Tom who?
He's gone. He's well gone.
I'm allowed one more. You'll like this one. 29th of February 2016, crossing back over the Atlantic. Actually, this is going on from the 29th to the 4th of March. Cigar competition takes place during annual Habanos Festival in Havana. Do you think you can guess what the aim of the game of the cigar competition is?
Rolling them?
No.
Smoking lots of
them? This might entail
smuggling them to Miami in a speedboat.
Who?
Smoking as fast as you can.
The competition sees...
Smoking it out of somewhere that's not your mouth.
The competition sees... That might fall within the rules of the competition. And actually, it could be an interesting point of debate among the judges, because the competition is to see which cigar smoker can create the longest unbroken ash. Brilliant.
Okay, that's pretty good, yeah.
That's pretty good.
Brilliant.
Mm. You almost need that cough button for that, Andrew.
I don't have any more details on that. I tried to find some videos or
that's
something, but I couldn't. I mean, you can only imagine it. I think that's a great criterion for deciding things between humans.
I would enter you for it, but I fear that I may get done by health and security, or health and safety rather, for making you smoke.
Object.
Okay.
Monocle 24 is famously the place where political correctness has gone mad.
Yes. It has.
But only just not on this show. This show didn't know that, did it, Andrew? We didn't get the memo.
Not at all.
We still run on facts here.
Henry, you've done a fine, fine job.
Appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
We love having you on the show. Thank you very much. And you have once and truly got rid of that old Tom Edwards. He's gone. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly. In a moment, we'll be hearing about London's fashion scene.
This week, London Fashion Week has been draping the city in sartorial excess, and the calendar is pretty crammed for these events at this time of the year. The past 7 days have also seen New York and Milan showcasing the top tier of clothing that their cities have to offer. For London, two names in recent memory have become synonymous with the city's fashion identity. One, Alexander McQueen, helped bring dark and gritty style to the catwalks, and his suicide in 2010 shocked the industry. Another, John Galliano, turned London's influence into a modern take on flamboyant glamour. But his fall from grace in 2011, after an unforgivable anti-Semitic rant in public, has seen him having to rebuild his empire almost from scratch.
The two separate journeys are profiled in fashion writer Dana Thomas's book Gods and Kings, The Rise and Fall of Alexander McQueen and John Galliano. And Dana is here to discuss those careers, as well as what style means to the City of London in 2016. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Now, first of all, you are not a fashion outsider. You're not somebody who came to this world just as somebody who was intrigued to see the terrible things that happen in the world of fashion. You're somebody who's written about this, understood the world very well. How did you get pulled into these two stories? And what made you think that they were worth, you know, wearing together, as it were?
Well, it was interesting. I actually always dreamed of being a political reporter. I studied politics in Washington, and then I went and got a job at the Washington Post. And my first assignment at the Washington Post was on the national desk, and I thought, I'm on my way to the White House. This is going to be great. And then the fashion editor, Nina Hyde, needed a new assistant. And she'd heard that I had been a model in Paris at 18 to pay for my way through college, and that I spoke French and a bit of Italian, and I knew Milan as well. And so she pulled me in to be her assistant, and that's how I got on the track of covering fashion. When I worked at Newsweek in Paris, one of my beats as a cultural reporter for them for 15 years was the fashion industry, since it is a capital of fashion in the world. And while I was there, two of the stories that I covered very carefully and very thoroughly were John Galliano and his ascent at Dior, and when Alexander McQueen was hired by Givenchy. So I'd been covering these two since the early 90s. John, I think the first time I met and wrote about John was in 1994. And I had reams and reams of notes, filing cabinets down in the basement storeroom of all of my press kits and things because, you know, before Google, we hoarded these things as foreign correspondents in case we ever needed them again. And I was writing a piece about John's downfall when I wrote this paragraph about how other designers had trouble and sort of buckled under pressure, whether it was self-medicating through drug addiction and had to go to rehab, or having, you know, suffering from depression, or the worst case was McQueen's suicide. And I thought, there's something more here. There's something to this that's a much bigger thing than a news story. And so I called my editor at Penguin because I had written a previous book, Deluxe, How Luxury Has Lost Its Luster. And I said, you know, I think this is more than an article. How can we shape it into a book? And we talked for about a half an hour. And I took a few notes and then I started on the proposal and boom, we were off to the races.
Does it feel like very much a snapshot of their particular time in the fashion industry and the global fashion industry with those two guys as the sort of starring roles in it? Or maybe I wonder whether we feel that we've got become too risk averse to even have people like that in the fashion industry in those top key positions nowadays.
I think it's a bit of both. I approached the book in three different ways. First, I wanted to make it an homage to wonderful fashion writing. So I quoted a lot of great fashion writers that we don't see anymore because they've retired or they're gone, and that kind of writing isn't often anthologized in books. So I pulled old reports by Bernadine Moores of the New York Times and Nina Hyde of the Washington Post from the 80s when John was just starting in the UK, in London. And then I quoted a lot from Amy Spindler, who was the wonderful New York Times writer who died about 10 years ago now. and who had been my editor for a while at the New York Times Magazine, and just really wanted to show what lyrical, great fashion writing there was at a time, and how in the world of blogging and Instagramming, we're losing that really, really quickly. The second thing I wanted to do was a bit of a biography of myself, showing that, you know, I had arrived in Paris and I had been covering these folks and we had sort of grown simultaneously together in this era that was really what I call a magical moment in fashion, when the companies and the business in general was just exploding, growing exponentially. And you had all these great new designers, a whole new generation just pushing to do something bigger and better. And the two leaders, of course, were Galliano and McQueen. They pulled everybody else up to a much higher standard.
Including the journalists, presumably.
Including the journalists and including stylists and editors, yeah. You know, with Isabella Blow. Everybody just had to work a little bit harder to measure up to these two geniuses who I compared to. In fashion, it's a bit like when we had Picasso and Matisse in art, two giants, completely different, but made everybody else work harder because the bar was set so high. There was less risk at the time because the industry wasn't quite so big. Just since my book Deluxe came out in 2007, the luxury fashion industry has grown from $200 billion a year in sales to $300. It's gone up 50% in 7 or 8 years. And back when we started this all in the early 90s, it was probably $100 billion. So it was a big business, but it wasn't a gigantic. So there was less at risk, and they were able to take wilder creative risks by hiring people like John Galliano and Alexander McQueen.
And tell me, you know, the debate around these two characters, you know, it kind of runs backwards and forwards. If you come in closer to today in time, there's still this, you know, argument: are many of the people, you know, jumping from the heading like the big fashion brands because they just cannot cope with the workload? It doesn't seem that it's eased up in this direction. But when you look back in history as well, there is a kind of sense, I wonder if you feel it has always been a little bit the case that this is the fate of fashion designers. When you look at Yves Saint Laurent, you know, he was, you know, self-medicating from very early on. He had mental health issues, all because of the pressure of running a fashion company.
I think it's a bit of both. I think that what has happened is that originally the designers were hired to be designers. They went to art school. They were artists in their heart. There are lots of people who say fashion isn't an art, including Bernard Arnault's son, who declared this quite clearly to me, and I quoted in the book. But you need to have an artist's sensibility, eye, soul, to be a designer. You have to have a sense of color and perspective and silhouette and proportion, and it helps if you know how to draw. And so because of that, they're already a bit sensitive. And then they've never gone to business school. They never learned to run businesses. Yves Saint Laurent always, you know, everyone is always using Yves Saint Laurent and Pierre Berger as the model. Well, he had Pierre Berger as his businessman, and Pierre Berger let Yves be the artist, and Pierre ran the business. Their offices were next door to each other. They communicated all very easily and well. It was a partnership, but it had, you know, it was definitely a separation of church and state in the way they were set up. Yves never asked about the business or how much they were making money or what things cost. And Pierre never said, I don't want you to use that because it costs too much. He just let him do what he did and he made it work. Now, today, the designers, well, for example, Christopher Bailey at Burberry, he's doing both now. He is the CEO as well as the creative director. And being creative director of a company that does a couple $1 billion a year versus being the designer of a house that does two collections a year and sells at three stores is a completely different game. You have to be a manager and you're telling other people what to do. You have to delegate. And it really does help if you know how to do that, or you've taken some classes in it, or you've had some experience in it. The reason the young designers today are able to do it is because people like Galliano McQueen have flamed out, and the schools see that part of the problem was that they never learned how to be managers.
But there was a feeling that people like Raf Simons, you know, that, you know, in the end, he just couldn't be doing, like, you know, so many collections and a cruise line collection, and so, yeah. You know, so they may be better business people, but even then, it's a struggle just to keep up with the demands on them
pace.
These days.
It's like being the artist and the gallery owner in one, isn't it? It's enough to drive you bananas, especially
yes.
if you're the kind of temperament that can be the artist. It's so rare to also have the business head. But I wanted to ask you, obviously your book has been read by the scions of the industry, and I do call it an industry. Do you hope that they find inspiration in it, in your painting of these two portraits, these two wonderful men, or whether it's a warning from history almost?
I surely hope so.
Yeah.
And it does seem like there is some movement. No one's saying I've got this idea from Dana Thomas's book, but I keep reading and hearing things here and there, like the buy now, sell now collections. versus working so far ahead, cutting collections down. Marc Jacobs has gotten rid of a couple. A couple of houses are, they're trimming it down, they're tightening it up. They're only doing one show with everybody in it instead of having a menswear, a womenswear, and da 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 da. They're editing their workloads in a way that seems more reasonable and less impossible.
Now, we're going to quiz you about London in a minute, but just tell me, with John Galliano, there have been attempts to bring him back. He's had support from other labels who want to use him. We've seen him showing again. You obviously have great admiration for his craftsmanship and his skill and his capacity to design. Do you think there is redemption, proper redemption, waiting for him?
I surely hope so. I do believe he has a guardian angel looking out for him, and that he will find his way again. He was in London this week for the 90th birthday of Joan Burstein, who officially discovered him by buying his entire degree collection for the Windows of Brown's. And it was the first time he'd been out sort of like that in a while. And everyone said he looked terrific, and the pictures, he looked terrific, and he was in great form, and he was just so happy to be there and so happy to be celebrating with Mrs. Burstein. And I felt like that was really a kind of a coming out in a way. You know, he's been quickly bowing after his shows.
And I presume that's a meeting loaded with significance. A Jewish lady.
The Jewish.
And, you know, someone who, if anyone is going to offer forgiveness, it's somebody like that. It matters from the most, I guess.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And showing his absolute and true adoration of and respect toward her as well. So he's been coming back slowly and quietly, and it should be that way. I think he just wants to get back to the art of making things, not just making noise. And that's what he's doing. And it's apparently making him very happy. I hear from loads of his friends. He's in great form. He's very happy. He hasn't been happier in years. He looks terrific.
And tell us, what do you make of where London stands at the moment?
Well, there was big news this week because for the first time since about the year 2000, 2001, the Alexander McQueen brand came back and showed in London. That after McQueen sold his company to Gucci Group, which is then PPR, which is now Kering, he chose to show in Paris. And he would schlep everything over to Paris for the big shows and then bring it all back. But the headquarters were always here. He wanted to compete with the big guys, the big boys, and, you know, Carl and John at Dior and, you know, all the big houses. And they've decided that instead, McQueen is essentially a London house. Why aren't we showing in London? And London is doing so well with Christopher Bailey at Burberry and Tom Ford and J.W. Anderson and Christopher Kane. There's lots going on here, so let's contribute to that rather than sucking the life out of it by decamping to Paris. So they brought it back, and it was really terrific. It just seemed right to be here because the clothes are so London-centric in their soul. And it was not the biggest star of the week like it used to be. It was just part of a really great week. Some of the things that happened this week was that the goth look is back, and that was apparent at McQueen.
But Andrew's breathing a sigh of relief there.
and you know, it started at the big, it was also in New York, and Marc Jacobs really, really showed it well at the close of New York Fashion Week. And then there was some here, preened by Thornton Bragazzi and then McQueen and a couple of others. Aerodom, I think, also had a bit of goth. But it was lighter and more delicate.
Well, power to that thought. For the time being, the author of Gods and Kings, The Rise and Fall of Alexander McQueen and John Galliano was Dana Thomas. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. It's been wonderful.
Time for a new tune now. This is Brooklyn-based songwriter Eskimo. This is Power.
Nice, a little bit of kind of shoegaze, a little bit of whimsy, a little bit of Belle and Sebastian. It's nice, wasn't it?
Yeah, very, very nice.
That was Gabrielle Smith, a.k.a. Eskimo, spelt like like the French, the plural of the French. And that song's called Power. And you are listening, of course, to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Madrid is a changing city. Unlike other Spanish destinations, Madrid hasn't bowed to the tourist hordes in order to weather the economic downturn. Instead, the regeneration has been led by Madrileños themselves. This newly reinvented Madrid is a melting pot of talent, taste, and citywide tenacity. Monocle's editors and correspondents share their discoveries in the new Monocle Travel Guide to Madrid.
If there is one thing to take from this guide, it's that Madrid isn't lacking in colour and diversity, and that's certainly the case for accommodation and hospitality. Hotels have a palpable Spanish flavour to them. Bespoke furnishings are made by local designers, and delicious menus prepared by Madrid's top chefs.
To catch a glimpse of Monocle's Madrid, head to the film section of monocle.com.
Okay, Rob, we've broken out of the studio for once. We've gone free range and we're here. We'll call it the studio of Monocle. It's actually normally the kitchen because here on the Monocle Weekly, we're always ready to get our sleeves rolled up, our hands dirty, and to educate ourselves in a new skill or possibly just make a bit of a mess. Our next guest is the perfect person to help us do that. Won Jin Ho is an artist and printmaker whose expertise has seen her teach the skill of printmaking around the world, most notably at East London's Printmakers Studio.
But you might also be shuffling a couple of Won Jin's works in your pocket because her designs of animals are currently gracing a series of special edition coins from the UK's Royal Mint, celebrating the Chinese Lunar New Year. This year's coin is the Year of the Monkey, and Won Jin's animal knowledge is second to none because she's also a trained vet, of course. How many strings to your bow do you have, Won Jin? And welcome to the programme, first of all. It's really great to have you here. Why don't we start with some of the things arranged on the table in front of us?
I brought in some coins.
Yeah.
These are coins that were designed in collaboration with the Royal Mint. And as you can see, there's three coins on the table. The first one that I designed was for the Year of the Horse in 2014. Last year was the Year of the Sheep. And 2 weeks ago, we had the Chinese New Year, and this is the Year of the Monkey.
We were talking amongst ourselves before we switched on the microphones, and you'd better tell us how you won this, how you won the commission for the Royal Mint, because that's not just, you don't just knock on the door and go, hey, it's me, I've found something in my down the back of my sofa that might be appropriate. Tell us how this one worked.
Well, I won a contest.
But tell us how it, where you saw the advert, how it was worded and things like that.
There was a call out for artists to make designs for a secret client, and the designs were to be made in metal. And the call out came through the Chinese Art Center Manchester, of which I was a member. So I got this email and I thought, well, why not? I make New Year cards every year, so I just sent my designs over. And then I got a phone call from Kevin Clancy of the Royal Mint Museum. I was convinced it was a hoax. I thought, this can't be true. But he was serious and he said, if I was interested, would I be able to make a couple of designs for consideration? So they'd asked a few artists. I did that and then spent the whole summer worrying about it, and then I won.
It's such a nice commission because you get to make one every year as well. So hopefully this will go on for, well, how many animals are there? There's a few more years to go yet.
There's 12 years in total. But they want me to do them quite quickly, so I should have finished them in the next few years. I don't have to wait until 2026.
Before we move on to the printmaking, we promised our listeners that Andrew and I were going to, well, all three of us are going to get our hands dirty and try some printmaking, because that's what you come in to talk about. But I just want to try to fuse, if I can, two elements of your CV together, Won Jin, and ask you, out of a monkey, a sheep, and a horse, which, as a vet, is the most difficult to treat? Come on, that's okay.
Horses.
Okay, so we have that.
Super fragile. Okay, yeah. They look big and magnificent, but they're just like very, very delicate creatures.
Yeah, there we are.
And they're very big to put in the x-ray machine as well. Tell us what's here on the table. So is this lino prints we're going to be making?
Actually, I use a Japanese vinyl, which is very similar to lino, but it was developed for, I think, the New Year gift card market in Japan, and you could go to the store in December and buy a little square of this green stuff, green plastic, take it home and carve it and print at home.
And just tell us, the process of making print for you then is caught up. There's many things you do before you get allowed to actually make a print. The carving, the choosing of the topics. How have you, over the years, developed your craft? Is it mainly in this format that you're doing it now?
I think I made my first print when I was 12, and it was a picture of a cat. So probably, yes, it's been like quite a few years of pictures of animals. I basically do a drawing on the block, as you can see here. And I draw directly and quite freely with a brush pen. And then I use a little knife, which actually is a Japanese woodblock tool, in the shape of a V. So it's called a V gouge. And everything you carve will come out white. You have to think that everything that you carve will be removed and not print. And on top of that, everything that you carve, when it's printed, will come out reversed. Which is why I've got some.
I know, I tried to read that,
to front
what you've got
writing.
Written on the back. And
I think I wrote Super Mama Monkey on it.
As you do.
And this is a great picture as well, because this is a mama and a baby monkey looking pretty amazingly cute together, presumably dancing from tree to tree.
Well, I was surprised, because you'd imagine baby monkeys would be more aerodynamic on the back of the mummy monkey.
Yeah.
But this baby and all of them cling underneath. So I thought it was pretty amazing to see this photograph of a monkey leaping from branch to branch with a baby underneath her belly.
I think we should start making some monkeys.
Yeah, so should we make some monkeys? I wonder when you were going to ask, Andrew, and we can start monkeying about.
Well, this is the first time, Rob, we can legitimately go ape at work.
It's happened before, but this is the first time it's been allowed. Okay.
So explain to us
What are we doing?
A printing ink, which is oil-based. This is like a toothpaste tube.
And I hear you're using your student card.
Of course, yes.
To
essential item.
God, that's a really beautiful colour, isn't it, that blue?
This is a little roller. You want to dip your roller in the reservoir of ink and then pull it downwards. Can you hear this?
Yeah.
Lovely sound.
Oh, lovely. Do you find this therapeutic?
Do you find talking therapeutic?
Yeah.
Then, yeah.
You've got to do it to someone.
Oh, very.
I call this every answer every question with a question thing.
So it's good for noise, but it's got a beautiful smell as well.
There is a gorgeous smell, So I'll print this print first, which is actually unrelated, but I'd like you to print the monkey print. And I want to demonstrate on a small print called China Love, which is a fictional triangular love story. So basically, you can hear the sound of the sea, right?
Yeah.
So when you ink up, you can sort of hear this gentle hiss, and then you apply the ink to the block. And every time you ink up, it's called a pass. So that was one charging of the roller, and this is one pass on the block, right? So you want to kind of make it nice and even, so don't worry about covering it with ink immediately. You can slowly build it up.
And tell me, so it's when you build up these layers on the block, why do you do it so many times rather than just, you know, you'd imagine you could just do one or two rolls across it to fill it up?
Yes, you can, but I have a very small roller for the size of my block because I cycled here. So that's why. If you want to kind of get down, you can see the light bouncing off the block, and you can see that there's a nice even layer of ink and that it's all the way to the corners.
And what are we putting? Is this just regular paper that we're putting it on?
This is actually, I love this paper. It's called Hosho paper, and it's also from Japan. It's a machine-made kind of washi, so a machine-made mix of paper pulp and probably kozo, which is the paper that is the most traditional kind of bark that they use for making Japanese paper.
It's kind of glossy yet porous.
It's glossy on one side and textured on the other side.
Nice.
I'll put the glossy side down. Mm-hmm. And then, have you ever seen one of these?
No, that's amazing.
This is called a baren, which is a handheld printing disc.
And it's about the size of a CD, and it's got lots of little kind of ball-bearing-y knobbles on it.
Yeah, and they move. So if you kind of touch them, they sort of glide in their little holes. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah. Like a ballpoint pen rolling around in there.
But several hundred.
Yeah.
Anyway, maybe you can hear this. Small circles and zigzags, right? And you can actually put quite a lot of force, like through your shoulder down to the disc. So this is very, it's super portable and it's quite strong, so you can see.
Oh my God, it's beautiful. Isn't it amazing?
So we've now pulled up the piece of paper. It says China Love, and it could have been done with a wood block as well. It has something quite old-fashioned about it. It's glorious in the way that it pulls out. And the characteristics on people's faces really... It's China Love. It's quite dark for China Love, isn't it? It's the people look quite haunted in some of the pictures. Amazing.
It's my fictional love triangle about this lady who goes to a hitman to tell him that she suspects her lover is being unfaithful, and to request that to avenge her honour, he kill him because she's secretly in love with a hitman.
This is good old-fashioned China love story, then.
A day later, the lover goes to the hitman and says, I'm absolutely convinced that my girlfriend is being unfaithful to me, and to avenge my honour, you must kill her. So there's this kind of like dilemma with a central hitman sort of completely paralysed with indecision as to what to do. And so I had this fantasy plot, and I've made it into 6 frames.
It's really beautiful. Can I make a prediction for how it ends?
If you like.
I think the two guys get together.
Now there's a solution.
Right. Okay, Rob, are you going to go first? Are you going to...
Yeah, what should I do?
If you make the ink into a line that's sort of the same width of the roller, and then you can just start rolling to and fro.
Have a roll.
Just kind of go to the back and then lift. Backwards, this way. I mean, towards
me.
Yeah. Go from here to here. Oh, well. Never mind.
Have I done it wrong?
No, it's fine.
You start just here, I think, Rob.
I was meant to start
there to here.
Sorry.
Are you right-handed or left-handed?
I'm right.
Okay, that's perfect. So now you've got it charged up.
Yeah.
Now you want to put some on this block. And don't worry about doing it all, but just do, bit by bit. That's perfect.
Don't laugh at me.
I'm not laughing.
I mean, it's fun to laugh.
It's an encouraging, encouraging smile.
So, Rob, meanwhile, is decorating part of the table as well as.
So I can see the monkey. I can see up in the trees. I started up in the top branch of the
tree.
Maybe
you could do a bit more there.
I can see some hairy mitts hanging onto the top branches of the trees. I can see a little baby monkey. I can see. Well, actually, they're all very playful monkeys. It's kind of like it's a little family of brothers or something. Have I got enough ink on there?
That's looking good, actually.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Do I need to get into the corners?
You need to go to that corner there.
Okay.
Yeah, nice.
Are they saying things to each other?
You can see there's something written there, right?
I know, it's like a rude phrase, because it's back to front. Andrew, can you make head nor tail of that?
No, but I think once you... we're almost ready at the paper stage, Rob. I think all's going to be revealed, I think.
Let's do
it.
I need to do a little bit more?
Maybe. Do you want to do some inking or do you want to...
I'll do the
I think you should do the printing.
I'll do the
printing.
Reveal.
Should I put the paper on?
Please.
Just smooth side down, maybe like that. And then just pat it to make sure it doesn't move. And then, And then you can... Yeah, exactly.
I forgot
the
name, it's
okay. The baren. So, actually, I usually use quite a lot of force, so I might be leaning over my circles and zigzags.
Andrew, do you do your own ironing? Does that remind you of anything?
I think I might be...
Are you a good masseur?
Ripping through my shirts if I ironed them in this way.
I don't want to ask a naff question, but is this genuinely de-stressing? I mean, it's a job, it's an art form and all the rest of it. But is it very pleasurable to actually get your hands dirty or rather use force on an object like this? Do you enjoy that side of it?
I love moving with my hands. It's the same as surgery, isn't it? Operating, it's the
and
same.
And there's something about the idea that people have done something similar to this for centuries appealing as well. Is the heritage of it something that kind of makes you excited as well?
I think for the Royal Mint, if you were to talk to the craftspeople, they're using incredible techniques that go back thousands of years. Mm. And that's where I think they really are walking in a line of heritage and tradition.
Yeah.
But this is kind of modern.
Am I allowed to do the reveal now?
Yeah, go for it.
Let's go for it. Let's see your handiwork, Rob.
Okay. He's okay, isn't he? It's Happy New Year. Yeah, that's what it says. Oh, it's really beautiful. And it's really well defined. There's definitely a touch of amateurishness, I think, in the lack of detail in some quarters. Am I right? If I were to have to critique this painting.
I think we did quite well. I don't think we've quite got it off in the same way as our teacher has, but I think if we're good pupils for the coming months, we might get there.
Good job.
Really? Well, thank you so much for the lesson. It's been an amazing introduction to your extraordinary craft, and to have just a few seconds at peering into what's made you so successful. So thank you very much.
We've got something both to hang on our walls, haven't we, Andrew?
Yes. Thank you very much indeed.
Hey!
Monocle's unrivaled network of editors and correspondents around the world bring you a brilliant new collection of books, the Monocle Travel Guides. And the series kicks off with New York and with London. London can be a big beast to tame, even for the people who get to call it home. But this ever-changing and regenerating capital can also charm you with its beauty. The Monocle Travel Guide to London is a celebration of all the things that the Monocle team loves about this mighty metropolis. And they're brave enough to let you see the wrinkles too. London's a global city, but the Monocle team will help you see it as a series of friendly local gems, with this guide to the shops, restaurants, music venues and museums we think should edge their way onto your itinerary. Whether it's a mid-morning run along the South Bank, the best Greek meal at Lamonia in Primrose Hill, or a handcrafted umbrella from London Undercover, our fresh ideas will leave you with a clear, crisp view of the capital. Published by Gestalten, these books are for people who want to get the most out of their stay, however short, and feel like locals rather than tourists. Pick up the Monocle Travel Guide to London in Monocle shops at monocle.com and in all good bookstores. The Monocle Travel Guides. Cities are fun. Let's explore.
We turn now to archaeology and a tale centuries old, but one that even the most up-to-date technology is still struggling to piece together. Ancient Lives is an online initiative that's been called the world's largest archaeological project. It's an attempt to translate 500,000 papyrus fragments unearthed a century ago at the Egyptian site of Oxyrhynchus. The Ancient Lives site allows translators from all over the world to collaborate on theories for a language with very few modern-day reference points to compare it to, and the papyrus range from poems to plays, private letters to even tax receipts dating from the 1st to the 6th centuries.
This Tuesday, a specialist in this field, Dr. Dirk Obink, will be talking at the Royal Geographical Society in London about some of the project's findings. The talk, The Past Today, is being presented by the World Monuments Fund, the organisation tasked with preserving some of the globe's most precious historic sites. John Darlington is the WMF's Executive Director in the UK, and he joins us now to sift through some of the ancient lives that the project is looking at. John, welcome to the programme.
Hi.
Now, that was quite an in-depth introduction to you, wasn't it? And necessarily so, because this is a work of kind of almost detective fiction, historical detective fiction. Maybe, as Andrew was saying in his part of the introduction, everything from tax receipts to poems to kind of historical post-it notes. Talk us through some of the things you found so far.
Well, I mean, the main thing is to say the discoveries, as you mentioned, were literally 100 years ago. So this is not a new discovery, but actually in the analysis of these literally thousands of bits of papyrus, that's speeded up no end because of this most recent partnership between Oxford University Archaeology Department and the Astrophysics Department, and they've come up with these new technologies which allow people to decipher and decode these bits of papyrus from wherever they may be, whichever sitting room they happen to be across the world. So that's the kind of background to it. In terms of discoveries, it's absolutely extraordinary because this collection of the very, very earliest writing is the kind of things that are coming up are the earliest Christian Gospels. You know, these are written down for the first time or visible for the first time here. They're things such as the plays of Plato, works of Homer, Euclid, new poems by poets such as Sappho. So there's an extraordinary richness to this collection.
These are all kind of amazing things. There's not a lot of mundanity in the things that you found so far then.
Well, no, there's...
There's notes to the milkman and things.
There are huge amounts of really, really dull things. There are lists there. I was looking at the other day, actually, at remedies for cataracts and poor eyesight. And literally, you read these remedies and you think, I'm surprised people don't go blind when they put them actually on their eyes, because they contain lead and all kinds of horrible, horrible things. So it ranges from those superstars of Greek and Roman literature all the way through to notes about contracts for bribery in wrestling matches. So it's amazing.
And just tell us, just the find 100 years ago, where were all these small fragments being kept?
So these were literally... Oxyrhynchus is a town in the middle of Egypt. And when it was first excavated, they were expecting the normal splendours of a Hellenistic town, which they got some of. But actually, the real gems were all of these papyrus, which were found in the rubbish dumps on the outskirts of the town. So literally, tons and tons of administrative waste was put into the rubbish dumps. Because of the microclimate and because of the conditions under the soil, those bits of papyrus don't disintegrate in the same way as they might in other places. So you've got the preservation in rubbish dumps.
And just tell me, in the history of ancient Egypt, where are we at this point when we are seeing these pieces of paper? Are people still writing in hieroglyphics, or have we moved on to a more recognisable form of a kind of alphabet?
Yes, they're absolutely writing in ancient Greek. That's what you're seeing. So if you can read ancient Greek, which personally I can't, but the tool which you're given when you join this project allows you to actually decipher it. But yes, this is very much ancient Greek, and this is when Egypt was part of the wider Hellenistic and then the Roman world. So it's not about pharaohs, it's not about hieroglyphs, and it's not about pyramids. It's more about chariot races and circuses and the Hellenistic, Romano-Hellenistic administration.
And just before I let Robert jump in, why did they not rot away, these pieces of paper, then?
It's dry conditions, so there's literally no moisture at all. So they were preserved beautifully under these dry conditions. In other parts of Egypt, you do actually have water levels which would destroy those, and it rises and drops, but in this case there's no water to destroy them.
Why are they finding it so difficult to translate these things you found, or is it more that it's the quantity of it?
It's absolutely the quantity. So you've literally, with 500,000 pieces from this collection in the Ashmolean in Oxford, belonging to the Egypt Exploration Society, you've got another 500,000 elsewhere, and it's literally the quantity. And some of them are absolutely tiny, so little fragments, which when they were first excavated, some got split up. So I was talking to Dirk the other day, and he was saying that they recently found a little bit of Homer in Oxford and a little bit of Homer, the same document, in Germany. So it allows that kind of cross-correlation across the world.
And you mentioned that Oxford University's archaeology department are working with the astrophysics department. I mean, we can obviously imagine what the first group of guys are doing, but what have the astrophysics department got to do there? Are they to do with the tool that is being used?
Yes, I think it's basically the technologies used as part of the kind of Zooniverse project, which is another big project. The technologies are based in astrophysics. That's where the collaboration began.
So is this some sort of reader? Is this a device, or is this just...
If you go online, you can actually look it up. If you go online, and essentially what you're given is, once you register, you're given a fragment of papyrus, and then you're given a little cue card on your screen, and you literally match the letters that you can see on the papyrus with a little cue card that you can see on the screen, and that will eventually come up with a translation. And if you're not sure, that's fine. You've got symbols to say not sure, you know, can't read that, don't understand.
So there's
that.
An idea of crowdsourcing of knowledge.
It's absolutely about that.
What happens? Have you had any sort of spoof entries where people have sort of? I would be slightly tempted to go, I'd like to be part of this, John. And then we go through the process, and you go, you're okay. You've got a brain and all the rest of it. And then I spoof you. Has that happened?
What sort of Martians of
exactly. You're like, something.
I think there's an academic control in this system as well, which would weed those spoof entries out.
It's just a Google away from happening.
Now, John, you also work here in the UK, looking after, there are monuments here to be protected as well. What does the fund do here in Britain?
Lots of things, actually. So whilst many people might not have heard of World Monuments Fund Britain, people will most likely have seen our projects. So we've worked in partnership with some of the most extraordinary pieces of architecture in this country. So the ones I'd give as an example would be Strawberry Hill in South London, which is Horace Walpole's sort of Gothic masterpiece, or St. George's Bloomsbury, one of Hawksmoor's London masterpieces, or Stowe House in Buckinghamshire, which, you know, if you look at that particular piece of architecture and the landscape it sits in, you have every great English architect has passed through those portals. So we work with those separate owners, separate trusts. We work with them to breathe new life into these places, to restore them and make them available to the public.
And what about the international reach of the World Monuments Fund that's not in the UK? What are we talking about these sort of temples in Syria and things that we see are being blown up left, right and centre at the moment? Does your work or does the fund's work extend to that as well?
Absolutely. So we've had a long history of helping places where catastrophes occurred, whether it's earthquakes in Nepal or whether it is the current crisis in Iraq and in Syria. So we're directly supporting projects in Iraq right now, and once the dust settles in Syria, we'll be again supporting people in that country with resources, but also training and help and assistance and moral assistance at the moment, which is what we do. So across the world, we've got big experience of stepping in, often, as I say, after the dust has settled, but stepping in and helping to restore heritage, because actually a lot of these countries, their reconstruction is often the symbol of heritage being reconstructed. Is a very great symbol for the country's reconstruction. So it's a positive.
Might not have meant anything for 2,000 years, strangely, but it means something when it's destroyed.
Yes,
and it means something if it's saved from destruction, and it becomes actually a secular thing. It becomes a beacon of hope, hopefully, right?
Yes, and we've just finished a project in Zanzibar at the moment, which is a Christian cathedral deliberately built on the site of the last slave market in Zanzibar. And that project is one which is not about a Christian site, it's about a Muslim workforce, a big Muslim economy, and there is much behind that particular project as Christian secular population. So it's really interesting how heritage can have a positive benefit as opposed to being used as a negative thing, such as events in Syria with Palmyra.
And just so when you look at the unfolding of events like that, do you end your day in despair when you watch things like Syria? Or it sounds like you're still hopeful, actually, that people do understand, even in developing economies and even tough moments, that there is value in these things and that they need to be looked after?
Yes, absolutely. So eternally optimistic around those things. And I was talking the other day to the Director General of Antiquities in Syria, so a man who is deeply emotionally engaged and involved with the protection of Syrian antiquity, and he would say exactly the same thing. This is so important for the people of his country to look after this heritage, and its reconstruction, conservation, post-conflict is going to be very important indeed.
I saw a car parked so a small car, smart car, parked so badly on Manchester Street, which is right next to the office here, and with some really amusing, nasty graffiti written in the dust on the bonnet, that I thought that almost is a monument to bad parking and kind of bad manners, and I kind of wanted that cast in stone, like a work of art. I thought that was a great monument to the London of the 21st century. That's of no particular interest, I just threw it in at the end.
Well done, Rob.
John Darlington, Executive Director of the World Monuments Fund, Britain. Thank you very much for a fascinating 10 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, it was all about print and paper and kind of things like that today, wasn't it, Rob? We had papyrus.
Papyrus. We had lovely Dana Thomas talking about fashion.
Her nice book out in paperback.
Paper. Very good.
And then we had printing.
We did, didn't we? It was all good stuff. I particularly love Wan Jin. She was particularly amusing, wasn't she?
Yes.
Giving us our masterclass in printing. I've got that upstairs on my desk.
I know, I've seen.
It's up on my notice board area. And I keep on sort of boasting about how good it, I made this. And everyone's like, you didn't really make it, did you? You just sort of rolled it. And Andrew sort of rolled it. And then you peeled away the paper.
I know. I think people got
I've got a way to come in my artistry.
We did the actual kind of carving involved, but no. But we do. My rubbing was rather good, I felt.
Yeah? Good rubbing?
Yeah.
Okay.
I rubbed it up the right way.
Hey. I don't know. I don't think we can really come back from that. Other than thanking our friends behind the glass, today's show was produced by Tom Hall. Our studio manager was Claire Urban and Toby Hammond. And the Monocle Weekly, of course, will be back same time, same place, probably still same personnel. But for the time being, have a wonderful Sunday. I've been Robert Bound.
And I've been Andrew Tuck.
Thanks for tuning in.